Okay, so I'm going to hand over to Vinil Kumar, who is a multi-talented socialist. He is one of the he's one of the organisers of this conference. He is designer extraordinaire of the left in Sydney and around Australia. So all of this stuff, the beautiful imagery you see before you, is Vinil's creation. And he's been really involved in the refugee rights campaign here in Sydney and also in the Palestine campaign. So Vinil's going to talk for about half an hour or so, and then we'll have plenty of time for discussion. Thanks, Vinil.
I agree. Martin Luther King Jr.'s immortal words, delivered on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, have inspired Americans of all backgrounds since they were spoken on that historic day in 1963. Dr. King's dream is our dream. It is the American dream. It's the promise stitched into the fabric of our nation, etched into the hearts of our people, and written into the soul of humankind. It is the dream of a world where people are judged by who they are, not how they look or where they come from.
Yeah, I really don't know where to start with that one. But I think if there's one thing to take out of that video, it's that clearly nobody can actually dispute the impact that the civil rights movement had. It was one of the most decisive struggles against racism, I think, in history. Over a decade of mass struggle involving millions of African Americans and people all across the United States, it achieved significant victories for Black America against the racist political establishment and the American state. It saw the defeat of Jim Crow segregation, the expansion of voting rights, and won improvements in the living conditions for significant sections of Black America. It radicalized a whole new generation of activists for who the civil rights movement was a launching pad for the Black power struggle, the fight against the Vietnam War, for radical struggles on university campuses and in the working class movement more broadly, and for questioning the entirety of capitalism as well for a small section. It raised the confidence and the expectations of the oppressed in the United States. It expanded the horizons of what was possible for them. And for many, in recent years, the election of Barack Obama, America's first Black president, was seen as the culmination of everything that the civil rights movement fought for half a century ago. However, the explosion of the Black Lives Matter movement in August of 2014, after the killing of Michael Brown, I think was one of the moments that really shattered the myth of a post-racial America. Despite the significant victories and gains of the civil rights movement, the election of African Americans to some of the highest offices of power, racism persevered and intensified in its brutality. For example, between 2012 and 2017, more than 2,500 African Americans were lynched by law enforcement. That figure amounts to basically one every 20 hours. There are now over 2.2 million African Americans incarcerated or under the supervision of the criminal justice system, and this number outstrips the number that were formerly slaves in 1850. The average Black family has one-tenth of the household wealth of the average white family, a gap that some estimates say would take 228 years to close, if ever. The person now sitting at the White House, and as you saw a moment ago, singing the praises of Martin Luther King Jr., is the world's most powerful white supremacist, someone who thinks the Ku Klux Klan, the group most synonymous with the racist terrors and lynchings of African Americans throughout U.S. history, this is someone that Donald Trump thinks are good people. So I think if there's one thing that the situation for African Americans today and the presence of Donald Trump in the White House really proves to us beyond a shadow of a doubt, it's that history is not an unrelenting march towards progress. In fact, for anyone who's paying attention, the scourge of racism in our society seems to get worse every single day. As we watch each racist horror and atrocity play out with shock and horror and revulsion, I think we must rightfully ask, how could things go backwards so horribly? But perhaps more importantly, we need to also ask now more than ever, when things seem darker and darker every single day, how can we take things forward once again, and how does the world actually change? And I think the civil rights movement is one of the most mythologized, mystified, and misrepresented events of the past century, precisely because it offers answers to these important questions. For those who run our society, those who write the history books, it's an episode of history. It's an episode of our past whose character must be distorted and whose lessons must be changed. The civil rights movement must become the passive and respectful congregation of its peace-loving preacher, Martin Luther King Jr. In this history, change comes from great individuals working alongside those in power, and the role played by ordinary people is a passive or unconscious one. The real and the radical history of the civil rights movement, I think, is a refutation to every single one of these lessons. Firstly, the movement was not something that was simply conjured or roused to action through the inspiring leadership, powerful words, or moral example set by Martin Luther King Jr. Now, to be sure, Martin Luther King Jr. played an absolutely important role in the struggle, but a view of history that focuses only on the role of great individuals breaks the link between oppression and struggle and writes out of history the agency and the power of ordinary people. Because in reality, it was the day-to-day reality of oppression in American society that spurred millions to act. Though slavery had been defeated in the Civil War, the oppression of African Americans endured. By the middle of the 1950s, Jim Crow segregation had reigned for decades in the South. And even in the North, blacks found themselves relegated to the most low-level and unsanitary jobs. They were shunted into inferior housing in rundown ghettos. They were disadvantaged in segregated schools, denied the ability to vote where they even had the legal right to do so, and subjugated to the brutalization and lynchings at the hands of the police and of white racists like the Ku Klux Klan. Now, over 500,000 African Americans had fought in the Second World War, and they returned home expecting to enjoy some of the freedom and democracy that they had supposedly been fighting for, and they were only to be met by segregation, poverty, and racist violence. But as a greater number of African Americans migrated to the North in search for work and became a greater proportion of the urban working class, they became increasingly combative, more confident in their own strength, and better organized. Early victories such as the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education ruling heightened their confidence even further, but this also provoked a racist backlash from white supremacists who basically just entered into a frenzy. And as part of that, in 1955, the lynching of teenager Emmett Till and the acquittal of his killers by an all-white, all-male jury in just 67 minutes sparked anger, and it drew 50,000 people to Emmett Till's funeral and sparked off what we know today as the Civil Rights Movement. Now, the struggle spread like wildfire, and I'm about to go through like some of the high points of that struggle, but I think it's really important to note that each major movement of each major moment of resistance spurred on the next, and significantly, out of each, new layers of activists were drawn to the movement. They began to organize, to develop their political ideas in response to the challenges that they faced. So on December the 1st, 1955, Rosa Parks, an activist with the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, refused to give up her seat to a white passenger and was arrested in a deliberate and politically calculated act. And I think this is important to recognize that what Rosa Parks did was a politically conscious act as an activist. And this sparked off the famous Montgomery bus boycott. More than 40,000 African-American residents walked for miles in their fight to desegregate the Montgomery bus system. And won after 381 days. And it was out of this campaign that Martin Luther King Jr. rose to prominence and the Southern Christian Leadership Congress, an organization dedicated to nonviolent mass action, was established. But while racists in the South also organized and attempted to beat back the movement, things could not really go back to the way they were. A couple of years later, on the 1st of February 1961, four black students sat in at a whites-only section of a drugstore lunch counter and they were refused service. The next day, 30 students joined in, and the next day after that, more than 50 black students and three white students joined in. By April, the sit-in protests had spread to over 78 communities across the South, and over 2,000 students had been arrested. A new student organization called the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or the SNCC, was established to organize further action. And by August of 1961, the sit-ins had drawn in over 70,000 participants, both black and white. The SNCC began to radicalize, and in 1961, they helped to organize and launch the Freedom Rides to protest the segregation of facilities on Greyhound and Trailways' southern bus lines. This campaign butted up against racist mobs backed by the political establishment. Riders were attacked and buses were bombed. Eventually, it became an embarrassment for the supposedly progressive Kennedy administration when it was clear that they had not acted in any way to protect the Freedom Riders. And further to this, following on from that, Martin Luther King's campaign to desegregate Birmingham saw thousands more join in the sit-in protests and marches. And television cameras famously captured activists facing brutal beatings at the hands of the police, fire hoses, and police dogs at the hands of figures such as the racist police chief, Bull Connor. Demonstrations erupted around the country in response to Birmingham and in outrage. And Kennedy, as a result of this mass public pressure, was forced to reluctantly intervene to begin to increasingly identify with the movement, and he was forced to announce that he would introduce a bill for civil rights. And this, this was one of the things that I think demonstrated the growing strength of the movement, but also it culminated and was further demonstrated when over 250,000 people marched through the streets of Washington in 1963. Now, the growth in the movement was also matched by a radicalization among some sections of it. In particular, the SNCC's own experiences in Mississippi pulled it to the left. Their attempts to intervene in the Democratic Party's convention was rebuffed as racist party officials refused to recognize them and had the police forcibly remove them from the convention. This led the SNCC to start to formally reject the Democratic Party as a party that could represent the interests of black activists in the United States. During the 1964 voter registration campaign in Mississippi as well, three civil rights workers disappeared and were later found to have been murdered by the KKK. The six-week campaign was beset by violence, seeing in total six black activists murdered, 1,000 people arrested, 30 buildings had been bombed, and 36 black churches had been burned to the ground. More and more, as the activists were faced with this kind of brutal violence, the SNCC, which was previously a non-violent organization, began to call for the armed self-defense of activists, and more they began to identify with the ideas of Malcolm X. In 1965 as well, the SNCC came out formally against the war in Vietnam. Now, all this was also matched by a new wave of struggles which erupted in the supposedly free northern cities in 1964. Now, in July, 15-year-old James Powell was gunned down in front of his friends and 12 witnesses by white police officers in Harlem. This might sound vaguely familiar to you. When officers were cleared of all charges, 6 nights of rioting erupted with over 4,000 people targeting the NYPD headquarters and calling for the officer responsible to be suspended. A string of riots then erupted all across the state. The governor mobilized over 1,500 National Guardsmen to quell the uprising, killing 4 and arresting almost 1,000 people. But this was not the end of the riots. In fact, the next summer, the ghetto of Watts in Los Angeles erupted after a racist police officer pulled over and assaulted a black motorist. This might sound familiar, again, to another story coming out of Los Angeles. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 had won important legal concessions from the political establishment. Yet racism was not just legal restrictions, but were manifested in daily life through crushing poverty and police brutality, something that faced blacks both in the South and in the northern ghettos. The urban rebellions in the latter continued through 1968 with eruptions in Chicago, Detroit, and most notably San Diego, and most notably in Detroit. Now, this period had a significant political impact on all levels of society. Now, the ruling class were terrified that the rural unrest in the South was now leading to explosive urban uprisings in the northern cities. The government had set up the Kerner Commission to investigate the cause of the riots, and the commission pointed the finger at growing poverty and inequality in the ghettos. Some concessions and social spending were won in areas where the rioting had broken out and been the most intense. And this was done as a measure to both respond to that, but as well as to diffuse the anger that was happening within the black community. President Johnson began to talk about the need of addressing these issues, while at the same time simultaneously lending credence to the idea that the problem lay with the weakened black family and the racist conception that African Americans just had a culture of poverty. Now, people's ideas began to rapidly shift in this period, and people started to come to radical conclusions. And this, of course, also includes everyone's favorite example of moderation, Martin Luther King Jr. He began to question his adherence to nonviolence as he was faced with how to relate to the anger in the urban black population and in the face of the U.S. government's growing violence in Vietnam. He concluded,
"And I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government."
And in 1967, he came out against the war in Vietnam and the anti-war movement gained strength off the back of the civil rights movement. And for doing this, he was basically slandered by the entire establishment, by the entire mainstream press, as if they didn't have reason enough to hate him already. This was an additional one on top of that. And King rightfully recognized and called out the hypocrisy of the establishment and the press.
"There's something strangely inconsistent about a nation and a press that will praise you when you say be nonviolent toward Jim Crow, but will curse and damn you when you say be nonviolent toward little brown Vietnamese children."
And when it became clear that the passage of the Civil Rights Act had not addressed the conditions of African Americans, he began the Poor People's Campaign and began to question economic inequality and the entire economic structure of capitalism.
"There are 40 million poor people here. One day we must ask the question, why are there 40 million poor people in America?
when you begin to ask that question, you're raising a question about the economic system, about a broader distribution of wealth. When you ask that question, you begin to question the capitalistic economy. Now, when I say questioning the whole society, it means ultimately coming to see that the problem of racism, the problem of economic exploitation, and the problem of war are all tied together.
Now, the urban rebellions had also mobilized new forces for the civil rights movement, and a new mood of confidence and militancy was summed up by two words: black power. The SNCC made a turn towards black separatism in 1966, expelling its white members. Yet black power had several interpretations. Some used it as an argument for reclaiming black identity through culture and personal expression. Others used it to argue for black electoral power. The phrase was also used as an argument for black capitalism by a newly emerging layer of black business elites and their backers in the establishment, including Richard Nixon. Now, black power's most dramatic expression emerged in the form of the Black Panther Party. Formed in Oakland, California in 1966, it became one of the most influential black political organizations of the era. The assassination of Martin Luther King in 1968 marked the end of the civil rights period and was used by the Panthers as an example and an argument that the nonviolent struggle had reached its limits. After centuries of violence at the hands of white racists and the police, this proposition was hugely popular, and the organization attracted thousands of members and enjoyed broader support amongst both blacks and whites. Though they're most identified with their armed neighborhood defense against racist police and their community charity programs, they explicitly identified as a black revolutionary organization that sought to overthrow capitalism. But their emphasis on armed struggle and their growing national prominence made them the target of severe state repression. The FBI's notorious COINTELPRO operation aimed to infiltrate and disrupt the activities of radical black organizations, as well as jail and murder its most prominent leaders. By basing themselves on the long-term unemployed instead of the urban working class, they could also not build a mass base that could counter this repression, nor put forward an actual strategy for overthrowing capitalism. The organization collapsed in the early 1970s, and some of its leaders eventually turned towards electoral politics and the Democrats. But while the Panthers could not build amongst workers, the civil rights movement helped radicalize a new wave of working class struggle. African Americans had for decades become a greater part of the urban working class, and the confidence and the militancy they developed in the struggle against racism didn't just disappear when they went back to work. The US saw an explosion of working class militancy between 1967 and 1974, particularly amongst public sector workers. Black nurses and municipal workers struck across the South, most notably in Memphis, where Martin Luther King was assassinated while supporting a strike of 1,300 black sanitation workers in 1968. In March of 1970, over 200,000 postal workers became the largest strike ever undertaken by federal workers in the United States. The government called in the military to try and intervene into the strike and trying to get them to sort the mail. But when the soldiers actually couldn't figure out how to do this properly, the idea basically failed utterly. And the government had to concede, resulting in a massive 14% pay rise for the postal workers and unprecedented collective bargaining rights for them. Now, out of this wave of labor militancy and off the back of the 1967 riot in Detroit, the Dodge Revolutionary Union movement emerged. Formed out of a 1968 Wildcat strike in Detroit's auto factories, this union of revolutionary black workers identified and recognized that black workers were the vanguard of the American working class and recognized the economic power that workers had to stop production and to overthrow capitalism. Their militant strikes against the bosses and their willingness to stand up to their conservative union leadership won them support both amongst black workers in other auto plants and the admiration amongst white auto workers as well. Yet, like the Black Panthers, Drum refused to organize white workers and accepted that the racism prevalent in society meant that they had to struggle separately. Ultimately, this hamstrung their own industrial effectiveness and meant a lost opportunity to build a multiracial revolutionary organization amongst militant workers. Now, with this history in mind, it's no exaggeration to say then that the civil rights movement represented an assault on multiple fronts against the ruling class and the political establishment. Every gain the movement made, every day people gained confidence in their own strength, every time organization developed and every time racist ideas were broken down through the struggle, all of this represented a significant setback and a threat to American capitalism. And this was not simply because those who ran American society were deeply racist, which of course they were. It was because racism has always been an essential part of capitalism. Malcolm X famously said, "You can't have capitalism without racism." And this was a conclusion that Martin Luther King and a new generation of revolutionaries had begun to draw. The divide at the heart of capitalism is one of class. Our society is run by a small minority who own most of society's wealth and who rely on the labour of the working class majority in order to produce their profits. Since workers of all races constitute the majority of society and we do everything to make society function, we have the power to overthrow the 1%. And in order for the minority to maintain their power and their privilege, they have to oppress us. This involves physically repressing us, making us feel powerless, and dividing us against each other. And thus, capitalism relies on different forms of oppression, which are both economically beneficial and politically useful for maintaining the rule of the capitalist class. Now, racism first developed in the United States alongside the new capitalist economy in the 17th and 18th centuries. It was part of making sure that black slaves and poor whites did not unite to overthrow their rulers, and it was essential in justifying the slavery of millions of Africans in order to build a new capitalist economy, while our rulers supposedly created a society where all men were supposedly created equal. Today, racism remains an essential part of pitting working class people against each other. It is essential for the ruling class to make us think that the biggest threat to our livelihoods is black criminals, or African gangs, or refugees, or Muslims, or Chinese workers, rather than the rich and powerful of all races who have a mutual interest in exploiting and oppressing all of us. Racism also remains extremely profitable, whether it's cheap prison slave labor from over 1.4 million black prisoners in the US, being able to pay lower wages to migrants, to migrant workers with fewer rights, or bosses even forcing white workers to accept lower wages for fear of being replaced by migrant workers. Oppression grinds us down. It makes us feel like we don't deserve more, makes us underconfident in our own abilities, our own power to control our own lives, and any hope of ever having power over how society is run. For all these reasons, racism has always and will always be extremely important to the survival of capitalism. It is why racism has been part of the rule of every party committed to running the capitalist state, whether it's Republican or Democrat or Liberal or Labour. The ruling class has a vested interest in maintaining racism, and thus, throughout the civil rights movement, the ruling class and the state fought tooth and nail to prevent any challenge to the racist status quo. It's why they protected or refused to act against the hardened racists like the KKK, and it's also why today they cannot be trusted or relied upon to deal with the rise of the far right. Now, the power to overthrow the system as a whole lies with the working class, the class of people of all races, religions, genders, and sexualities who do all the work in order to make society function. We can not only shut down our individual workplaces or entire cities, but the working class can take control of the entire economy and run it democratically to fulfill our needs rather than to satisfy the profits of the rich. Unity is absolutely necessary for the working class. Without it, workers cannot win a strike, and we certainly can't make a revolution. Thus, struggles today against every manifestation of racism are essential parts of the struggle against capitalism as a whole. Every victory against racism strengthens our side, builds our confidence and organisation, it unites us, breaks down backwards ideas, and makes important gains in the lives of workers and the oppressed. Not only are capitalism and racism inseparable, so too are our struggles against both. Now, in this light, the civil rights movement was not just a struggle against racism, but was rightfully seen by the establishment as a threat to the entire capitalist order. Yet capitalism was not overthrown. The ruling class emerged from this period bruised and battered, but still firmly in control and desperate to reassert their power and dominance. Thus, the mid-1970s saw a harsh economic recession and a downturn in both the working class and black struggles. In this context of retreat, the ruling class wasted no time to push back. This project had three elements: physical repression through the expansion of the police state, an ideological attack on poor and working class blacks, and the cultivation of a black middle class which could discipline the broader black population. In 1994, President Nixon's former domestic policy advisor, John Ehrlichman, was caught being honest about how the administration would repress the movement, and his response, I think, is worth quoting in full. The Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black, but by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and the blacks with heroin, and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night in the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did. Now, crime, even where African Americans were disproportionately the victims of crime, was used to whip up a hysteria about the crisis facing American cities. Public funding was directed away from social services and welfare to bolstering a police force and prison system which disproportionately punished black victims of poverty. urban blacks, once the heroes of the radical era, were now stereotyped as lazy welfare queens by Ronald Reagan and were demonized as criminals and super predators by Democratic Bill Clinton. And you might recognize this scene from the 2016 election campaign, where Black Lives Matter protesters confronted Bill Clinton about his horrible record in office, and he basically defended every single thing that he did. This was part of not only an attack on Black America, though, but on the broader working class movement as a whole. It was largely an attempt to shatter the solidarity forged through years of struggle and to destroy hard-won gains. Over the course of the past 40 years, the prison population in the United States boomed from approximately 200,000 in 1976 to over 1.4 million in 2016, of which Black people comprised 33%, the single largest racial group. Now, sorry, one moment. Now, while cell doors slammed shut on an alarming number of Black people, doors to power opened up for a small section of the new Black middle class with the support of the broader political establishment. The success stories of Black political leaders and the business elite were held up as proof that there were no longer structural barriers preventing Black progress, only individual failings. This narrative of colorblind institutions, of individual responsibility and individual choice, became the new forms of racism in the United States. A new generation of Black officials, historically aligned to the Democratic Party, took control of some of America's biggest cities in a tumultuous economic climate and were forced to manage them with dwindling funds and resources. Accepting their role as managers of American capitalism meant keeping businesses profitable through privatization at the expense of public infrastructure and social spending. It meant managing the effects of poverty, namely crime, drugs, and social discontent, by pouring funds into law enforcement and prisons. With their entire existence predicated on preserving the institutions of capitalism, not only is this layer largely granted amnesty from the worst conditions faced by the majority of African Americans, but they become an active part of creating those conditions. A commitment to the smooth running of the system means that civil disobedience, protests, riots, and any other form of resistance becomes an anathema to the Black establishment. Now, all of this is the context in which the Black Lives Matter movement exploded in 2014, as a reaction to the conditions created over the last 40 years and faced with the new challenges that have been created since. On the 9th of August 2014, Michael Brown was murdered in Ferguson, Missouri by Officer Darren Wilson. Ferguson was a culmination of the preceding 40 years. The decimation of Black living standards, the criminalization and demonization of Black people, the bolstering of law and order politics. Unemployment in the majority Black city more than doubled in the preceding decade, and poverty doubled in the preceding 3 years alone. In that year itself, in 2014, 86% of police stops and 92% of police searches in Ferguson targeted Black people. Media coverage of Brown's murder disgracefully highlighted his supposed criminality and not that of his killer. But Brown's murder sparked the first demonstrations under the banner of Black Lives Matter. The protests and riots in Ferguson were met by a police force that had been increasingly militarized over the past decade. Ferguson was reflective of the broader situation of Black America, and the solidarity demonstrations around the country brought national attention to the case and demanded justice for Michael Brown. But on the 24th of November, the grand jury investigating Darren Wilson decided the officer would not face any charges. Protests once again erupted in outrage. And the next day, America's first Black president weighed in.
Now, as I said last night, there are productive ways of responding and expressing those frustrations, and there are destructive ways of responding. Burning buildings, torching cars, destroying property, putting people at risk, that's destructive, and there's no excuse for it. Those are criminal acts. And people should be prosecuted if they engage in criminal acts. So don't take the short-term easy route and just engage in destructive behavior. Take the long-term hard but lasting route of working with me, governors, officials, to bring about some real change. And to those who think that what happened in Ferguson is an excuse for violence, I do not have any sympathy for that. I have no sympathy at all for destroying your own communities. Oh,
wow. Yeah, it's really hard to decide what's more appalling in Obama's response. protesting and rioting against the system is labelled as criminal acts and violence, but the murder of a black teenager is not. In Obama's eyes, it is not poverty and police brutality that is destroying African-American communities, it is black protesters. Obama's main message, ultimately, is this. Don't fight against the racist institutions that are killing black people and then setting their killers free. Work with them. Now, the distance between the black establishment and those on the streets of Ferguson, I think, was further illustrated at the funeral of Michael Brown. Now, back in 1955, Emmett Till's mother opted for an open casket funeral for her son and used the image of her son's brutalized body as a call to arms against racism in the United States. But almost 60 years later, Reverend Al Sharpton made Michael Brown's funeral an entirely different affair.
God beats up. I'm killing and shooting and running around gun-toting each other so that they're justifying trying to come at us because some of us act like the definition of blackness is how low you could go. Blackness has never been about being a gangster or a thug. Now we get to the 21st century. We get to where we got some positions of power. And you decide it ain't black no more to be successful. Now you want to be a nigga and call your woman a hoe. We've got to clean up our community so we can clean up the United States of America.
Now, both Obama and Sharpton disgracefully bolstered racist narratives about black criminality and violence while denouncing black protesters in a way that no white politician would have ever been able to get away with it. And in doing so, they deflected attention away from the underlying issues of state violence and systemic poverty and instead blamed the oppressed for their own oppression. Now, this is no accident, but the logical conclusion for a layer of society that sees its role as the managers of American capitalism, who benefit from the status quo and who rely upon the state to protect its own power and privilege. This is what lies behind the condemnation of resistance, calls to work within the system, and the weaponization of the civil rights movement against those who resist. And I think you couldn't find a starker contrast between Obama, who lines up with the police against black protesters, and Martin Luther King Jr., who marched with black protesters against the racist state. Yet, despite this conservative backlash against the protests, and precisely because the story of Michael Brown was all too familiar and would resonate and echo in the stories of Trayvon Martin, Tamir Rice, Eric Garner, Sandra Bland, Philando Castile, and hundreds of others, precisely because of this, protests spread around the country and drew solidarity from across the world. It fueled a movement around the United States that exposed the ongoing brutality and poverty faced by black America. Solidarity also came from workers both locally and around the country. Five workers from a local Ferguson Chipotle fast food outlet donated $1,000 worth of chips and burritos to the protesters and marched alongside them. A group of Pizza Hut workers organized out-of-town donations and made contributions of their own. And a group of UPS workers discovered that one of their clients was a company called Law Enforcement Targets, which provided the Ferguson police with practice targets, specifically this urban violence range, which basically features images of black men. Now, these workers decided that they would refuse to handle these deliveries in a campaign that they called Hands Up, Don't Ship. Several months later, that rage reached new heights when Freddie Gray was murdered by police in the back of a Baltimore police van. Protests began as details of his arrest and death became public, and riots erupted after police attacked high school students in the hours after Gray's funeral, and the students fought back. Thousands took part in the rebellion, hundreds were arrested, including 49 children. The riots eventually resulted in the charges being brought against six police officers involved, but unsurprisingly, these would later be dropped. But the protests and the solidarity that they garnered were a defiant warning to the state and to the ruling class that they could not simply continue to destroy black lives with impunity without facing repercussions and a fierce fight back. The politicization of a new generation, unwilling to accept the brutality of the American state and coming to grips with the racist and unequal nature of society, reverberated far beyond the immediate protests. As the 2016 elections drew near, activists confronted the racism of Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton, and thousands disrupted Trump's election rallies, most dramatically in Chicago. Today, the consciousness surrounding black oppression echoes in every struggle, from the mass high school walkouts raising demands to disarm the police, to the teachers' rebellion earlier this year. Those marching against the deportation of migrants and the resurgence of the far right include those politicized by Black Lives Matter. just as the civil rights movement galvanized a new layer of activists and flowed into broader social struggles, so too does Black Lives Matter illustrate how capitalism and oppression continually create hope embodied in a new generation of rebels. Now, I'd like to return to the question that we began with and what we can learn from the history that connects the dots from civil rights to Black Lives Matter. How do we take things forward? How does the world change? And these are questions that the movement itself has had to try and deal with. And one common answer that came up for years was the answer that we had to fight for greater representation within the institutions of power. Now, there's no doubt that the institutions largely do not reflect the diversity of the broader population. And this is a result of the struggles of the 60s and 70s, really. And as a result of these struggles, these institutions are actually more diverse than they were 50 years ago. It was mass struggles of the oppressed that made gains and forced the establishment to open its doors as a means of co-option. And I think we should not mistake the effect for the cause. Today, there are more black officials and black politicians than ever before, more black cops and black police chiefs, more black CEOs. Yet this has not led to the improvements in the living conditions of working class and poor blacks in the United States. And I think this approach rests on two fundamental misunderstandings. Firstly, the racism inherent in the institutions that run our society is not a product of the white people who run them, but the nature of these institutions as tools of the ruling class to oppress the majority. Secondly, what motivates those in power is not sympathy for those of their oppressed race. The example of Obama and Al Sharpton should be just two of those. But what motivates them is actually the class interest of preserving their own power and privilege against those who have neither. It's not enough, I think, to work with or within the institutions of power. Those institutions have to be fought and ultimately smashed. And I think it then follows that we can't simply appeal to the better nature of those in power. But nor should this mean that we abandon any hope of ever winning change, simply vote for the lesser evil, or focus on telling our own stories to change the hearts and minds of those around us. Those in power only ever give in to our demands when they are forced to. And I think in the words of Aretha Franklin, if you can't get no peace, you've got to disturb the peace. It's mass action, disrupting society, not letting business as usual continue, that is the key to winning our demands. And I think that's where the great power of the civil rights movement lay. It was thousands of people on the streets, sitting in, not being turned around by water hoses and police dogs. It was the rebellions of the urban poor. It was the wheels of production grinding to a halt at the whim of striking postal workers across the US, or at the whim of sanitation workers in Memphis or the auto workers in Detroit. It is these forms of collective struggle that actually pressure those in power to give in to our demands, that build our confidence in our own collective power and teach us lessons for the next struggle. It is precisely the sort of things that those in power today criticize about any attempts to change the world. So I think if you ever want to know what's the right way to change the world, you only need to pay attention to what those in power say is the wrong way. Now, recognizing that capitalism creates and relies upon every form of oppression to maintain the rule of the rich also carries with it important implications. It means that we have a collective interest in each other's struggles. The task of socialists today is to draw the links between our struggles and to recognize our collective responsibility towards every struggle. We need to rebuild the politics of solidarity, politics that unite our struggles rather than tries to separate them from one another. It's not your struggle over there and my struggle over here. Every struggle is our struggle. Every victory against racism strengthens our side, it builds our confidence in our organization, unites us, breaks down backwards ideas, and makes important gains in the lives of workers and the oppressed. But while the system continues, our victories are only ever partial and temporary, and that's why every victory has to be seen as a stepping stone to overthrowing the system in its entirety. Racism cannot be eradicated while a minority class that needs it, creates it, drives it, and benefits from it continues to wield power over society and its wealth. Black Panther Fred Hampton put it perfectly: "You don't fight racism with racism, you fight racism with solidarity. You don't fight capitalism with black capitalism, you fight capitalism with socialism." And to conclude, Emmett Till and Trayvon Martin were both black teenagers who fell to the racist vigilantes and were denied justice. James Powell and Michael Brown were murdered by killer cops who walked free, and their deaths ignited uprisings that rocked the political establishment to its core and made the world sit up and pay attention. Capitalism makes oppression a day-to-day reality, and as long as it does, it will create resistance. 50 years ago, a new generation was politicized in one of the greatest struggles against oppression in history. And today, a new generation is continuing that same struggle. The kids on the streets of Baltimore today, 50 years ago, would have been the very same kids boasting to Martin Luther King Jr. after the Watts Rebellion that they had won. The teachers today rebelling against Trump, march in the footsteps of the sanitation workers in Memphis and the Detroit auto workers. We stand on the shoulders of a generation of activists who could not just stand by, who fought, who died, who won victories, who suffered setbacks and learnt lessons in their struggle for a better world. And today, the responsibility for taking that struggle forward lies with us. Our generation is not the first to fight oppression, but if we can learn their lessons, take inspiration from their struggles, organize, and fight like hell, we might just stand a chance of being the last.